I got a 187 in Glendale.
This might date me, but when the movie The Fast and the Furious came out, you know, the first one, I was in high school. And I remember really clearly that the movie seemed to transform my little town of Coos Bay, Oregon, overnight. Suddenly, all the guys were putting NOS canisters on their cars. Weekend drag races popped up at the dunes. This summer, the franchise released Fast and Furious 9.
All right, Dom. What's next?
Except apparently now they're just called F and the sequel number.
I think the first one I watched in theaters was F5 or F6.
Yeah.
That's kind of when the franchise started becoming more Mission Impossible-esque, I guess you could say.
Yeah. That's Ethan Lee.
I'm a rising junior at Stanford studying political science, and I'm interested in media and international policy.
He wrote a piece last summer for our website, Inkstick, about the ways that the new live-action Mulan differed from the 1990s animated version, in part because of China's censors. So I wanted to get Ethan's take on an incident involving an actor from the new Fast and Furious, or, well, F9.
Former pro wrestler John Cena has touched off an international controversy.
Yes, so in an interview, John Cena said that Taiwan would be the first country to see F9. That didn't go along well with the CCP.
That's the Chinese Communist Party.
So he apologized for the slip-up on Weibo, I believe.
The Chinese government was not happy with that reference to Taiwan as an independent country, so Cena quickly apologized in Mandarin.
Yeah, it turns out Cena has been studying Mandarin in his spare time for a decade. But all that work didn't get him very far with Chinese audiences. Ethan, I read that folks were even commenting, like, that's not good enough. You need to recognize Taiwan as a province of China, and you need to do that in Mandarin as well.
Yeah, and it hasn't been received too well on both sides of the Pacific.
It just shows you how in bed our corporate overlords are with a totalitarian regime that didn't get arguably the toughest actor in Hollywood to offer a groveling apology in Mandarin.
It felt like a forced confession. It's illustrative of this very heavy-handed pressure that the Chinese apply when someone crosses them.
These things just make obscene amounts of money. You know, F9 wants to make sure that they have access to the Chinese market, and then what John Cena said threatened that. They're kind of in damage control, and is a larger systemic issue in Hollywood recently where, you know, a lot of films have been worried about trying to appease the party state and its kind of censorship apparatuses, trying to gain access to the Chinese market.
Bear in mind that this is relatively new. For decades, American films barely even made it to mainland China. And until the 1990s, American producers weren't exactly losing sleep over whether or not their films got distributed there. China wasn't considered a make-or-break market. But now, China is such a significant source of revenue for Hollywood that some of America's wealthiest media corporations, in one of our top 10 biggest industries, bend over backwards to accommodate the Chinese Communist Party. Could other American interests start to bend toward China, too? On this episode of Things That Go Boom, we talk about China's rise and how China's middle class is driving Biden's strategy for America's middle class.
Hi, I'm Tyler Foggett. Join me and my colleagues as we go beyond the headlines and deepen your understanding of the forces shaping our world today on The Political Scene, a newly updated podcast from The New Yorker. With episodes 3 times each week, The Political Scene accesses the sharpest minds in politics for insight and analysis about everything from abortion rights to the war in Ukraine. Make sure you're following The Political Scene, available now wherever you get your podcasts.
I came of age in the 90s. I mean, I'm a product of post-Cold War triumphalism. I didn't regard American preeminence as some kind of aberrant phase. I just regarded it as sort of an inbuilt condition of world affairs. It was that deeply entrenched.
That's Ali Wine, a senior analyst with the global macro practice at Eurasia Group. He says it's hard to convey just how dramatic China's recent transformation has been. In fact, he likens it to this moment just before the fall of the Soviet Union.
So at the time, the Berlin Wall has come down. The Soviet Union hasn't formally disintegrated, but the writing is on the wall, no pun intended. But it's early 1990, and Václav Havel...
His Excellency, Václav Havel, President of the Czechoslovakian Socialist Republic.
He comes to Congress, and he's reflecting on the pace of the Soviet Union's disintegration.
Havel takes a look down at his notes and delivers a sober analysis of the Soviet Union's impending doom.
We have literally no time even to be astonished.
I came of age thinking of China as diplomatically isolated, economically impoverished, and the idea that China, 20 years later, would be seen as having a plausible path to overtaking the United States for global preeminence. I mean, it's just, we haven't had time to be astonished. I think we're still processing the import of Beijing's resurgence. It's remarkable.
So how did we get here? To this place where China's rise feels like whiplash? Well, it starts in the late 1970s, when Deng Xiaoping implements a series of reforms that loosen the central government's control over the country's economy. He reopens China to foreign investment for the first time in over half a century. And he creates these things called special economic zones, basically places with tax incentives and fewer economic restrictions like Shenzhen, set up to attract foreign and domestic businesses. And it works.
Across China, there are 150 million workers, one-third of them women, who have left their villages to work in the factories, the hotels, the restaurants, and the construction sites of the big cities. Together, they make up the largest migration in history. Very few of them would want to go back to the way things used to be.
That's a 2012 TED Talk from journalist Leslie T. Chang. And, of course, one thing it leaves out is that there are still a lot of inequalities we can't ignore. China's economic reforms catalyzed a giant gulf in access to wealth and resources that's still widening, especially between people in urban and rural areas. The environmental consequences have been huge, too. But under these new policies, China did manage to pull a big chunk of its population out of poverty and establish itself as the world's manufacturing hub. And everything was going along fine until the Great Recession in 2008, when the American economy showed it's not as steady as we'd all acted like it was.
There is a recognition or conclusion among China's leaders that Beijing can no longer count on interdependence with Washington to be a stabilizing force.
Then in 2018, this other thing happened.
We've taxed China on $300 billion worth of goods and products being sold into our country. For many years, China has been taking out hundreds of billions of dollars a year and rebuilding China. It's time that we rebuild our country.
The imposition of tariffs, according to two Wall Street journalists, Bob Davis and Lingling Wei, they refer to the imposition as China's Sputnik moment.
Meaning that the whole thing was a wake-up call to China. Global power structures had shifted under its feet, and it had to take action fast.
And so the idea is we've harvested a lot of the gains that stood to be accrued from kind of the low-hanging fruit, being sort of the world's manufacturer. For China to embark on this next phase of growth, it is going to have to cultivate greater self-reliance in these emerging frontier technologies.
So in order for China to become more self-sufficient, in May 2020, the central government introduced a new policy called dual circulation.
Dual circulation, it consists of two tracks. And the idea is that China is going to try and prioritize domestic consumption and innovation, hence the internal circulation track. But it's not going to close itself off from globalization. It is going to remain open to participating in the global economy, hence the external circulation track.
But China doesn't just introduce dual circulation in order to continue to grow. It also needs this policy to avoid slipping back. And the reason China is at risk of slipping back, that has to do with its middle class.
They have the most middle-class people in the whole world. It's around 400 million people. Maybe 450 million people are in this middle class, right? And it's up from 10 million in 2000. So it's gone up astronomically. But there's 1.4 billion people in China, right? You know, that means there's 950 million low-income people in China, too.
That's Scott Rosell.
I'm the director of the Stanford Center on China's Economy and Institutions. I'm a development economist, and I've worked on China 39 years.
Scott says that if China wants to keep that middle class thriving and continue to pull more of its low-income population out of poverty, it has a significant economic hurdle to clear. 10 years ago, if you walked into a Walmart, nearly everything on the shelves was made in China, but not anymore. These days, more clothing labels and electronics equipment say made in Thailand or Malaysia or Vietnam. And this is something that economists call the middle income trap. This labor shift happens when a developing economy basically becomes a victim of its own success. As a country's per capita income goes up, workers expect higher wages. So the foreign companies who were initially attracted there by the opportunity to pay low wages, well, they move their factories to other countries where the low wages are still accepted. And this would be fine if the country that just lost its low-wage jobs could recruit companies from industries that are considered more high-skilled. But those industries, they know that the country doesn't have the training infrastructure to educate its workforce enough to be competitive in those jobs. And without enough jobs, the country's economy slips, or even collapses back down.
Brazil falls deeper into its worst ever recession. And keep in mind, Brazil was once one of the world's fastest growing economies.
Argentina defaulted on its $100 billion loan. Millions fell into poverty as unemployment soared.
These concerns about the economic crisis in Turkey, where the lira has tumbled to a fresh record low, Jim.
It's remarkable. In the past 70 years, there's only been 15 countries that have gone from middle income to high income. Now, it's not counting Eastern Europe that went from high to middle to high. And so it's a really hard thing to do. And most countries in the world are middle income, and they've been middle income for 70 years. And they grow, collapse.
For the countries that made it past the middle income trap, is there anything in common that they all did?
What differentiates these graduates, right? The South Koreas, Ireland's, Israel's, Taiwan province from the Brazils, Argentinas, Turkeys, right? And the difference is they're the human capital of their labor force. They all had rich country levels of education when they were middle income. Ireland educated all of their young people. And, you know, Taiwan did the same thing, and Israel did the same thing. And, you know, China's labor force is 800 million people. It has the lowest educated labor force in the entire middle income world. Only 3 out of 10 people have ever been to one day of high school. 600 million people are out there working hard every day. They're junior high grads at best, and they barely can do arithmetic. They're literate, they're disciplined, but that's it. And so how do those people move themselves into this high income, high wage, high skill economy? I think it's gonna be really, really tough.
So it's crucial for China to keep investing in its middle class, but not just for the sake of its own economy. Because China's internal success is also at the heart of its current competition with us, the U.S. And the key to understanding is to take a new look at the political motivations behind one of the most famous Supreme Court cases of all time.
Our enemies are gloating over this incident and using it everywhere to misrepresent our whole nation.
Stay with us.
In the aftermath of World War II, you have this wave of decolonization that it sweeps across much of the world, but primarily across Africa and Asia. You have a number of newly independent countries, and most of those countries comprising predominantly non-white populations. And they are looking to the two predominant powers of the time, the United States and the Soviet Union, and they're looking to see which country is doing a better job on improving race relations, making amends for racial injustice. And because of the state of racial relations in the United States at the time, the Soviet Union, it's looking to make ideological inroads across this vast stretch of newly developed countries. And it sees in the state of America's race relations an opportunity to basically sell a message to the rest of the world.
Since 1948, the Soviets have been carrying on a vicious propaganda attack on every phase of U.S. life. Through such anti-American propaganda, the Kremlin is trying to drive a wedge between the United States and the rest of the free world.
They sell a message that, look, the United States claims for itself the mantle of civil rights, equality, but look at how it treats its minority population. And there were a lot of concerns among U.S. government officials that these messages coming from Moscow were starting to gain traction, and they were starting to undermine not just the power of America's democratic example, but also, by extension, the reach of U.S. foreign policy.
Typical of the way they distort the truth are the scenes which we shall see in a moment from a Soviet newsreel prepared for East Germans.
Negroes in the limelight, but only as harmless, hand-picked ornaments. Their brothers and sisters rot, beasts of burden without rights in the paradise of freedom.
And so the Truman administration files a brief to the Supreme Court, basically urging the Supreme Court to rule in favor of desegregating public schools. And the brief really places a strong emphasis on foreign policy. And the administration in its brief says, the United States cannot credibly make certain statements about the state of racial equality in the United States when it's engaging in practices that belie that rhetoric. So Brown versus Board of Education, it's rightly celebrated primarily as a major victory for the United States domestically, advancing the cause of civil rights at the United States. But it had very profound foreign policy implications. Brown versus Board of Education, it did not fix race relations in the United States. It did not prevent the Soviet Union from continuing to launch broadsides against the state of race relations in the United States. And in fact, it illustrates nicely this symbiosis between domestic renewal and external competitiveness.
Being a global leader or a great power isn't just about having the biggest military or the richest 1%. It's also about setting an example that others look up to and enjoying the political influence that comes along with such respect. So the narrative that others tell and you tell about yourself, it matters.
If I were to try and summarize what is the state of narrative competition between the United States and China, I think that China is trying to gain traction for two parallel reinforcing narratives. The first narrative is that of Beijing's inexorable resurgence, and then in parallel, that of America's terminal decline.
Well, between our two countries, we've had confrontation in the past, and the result did not serve the United States well. What did the United States gain from that confrontation? I didn't see any. And the only result was damages done to the United States. And China will pull through and has pulled through such confrontation.
Or as they say in F9.
I spent my entire life in your shadow. And now you spend the rest of yours living in mine.
In January of 2021, I think a lot of observers said, my goodness, look at the insurrection that occurred on January 6th. 4,000 COVID deaths in early January. There were a lot of observers who said maybe America's ability to rebound is in question.
The Biden administration is pushing back.
I think the United States, on the flip side, is trying to say, now look at where we are about midway through 2021. Look at the progress of our vaccine rollout. We are on pace in 2021 in the United States to grow faster than we have since 1984. We are rebuilding alliances and partnerships. And so I think that there's very much this sense that the United States, it's renewing itself at home, it's repositioning itself abroad.
Both sides are also jockeying to be seen as holding the moral high ground in terms of human rights.
There are a number of areas where we are fundamentally at odds, including China's actions in Xinjiang, with regard to Hong Kong, Tibet, increasingly Taiwan.
We hope that the United States will do better on human rights. China has made steady progress in human rights, and the fact is that there are many problems within the United States regarding human rights, which is admitted by the U.S. itself as well.
It's quite a striking contrast between now and 1989. So in 1989, China experienced not only widespread opprobrium for its crackdown at Tiananmen Square, but it also faced sanctions. It faced a very, very challenging uphill battle diplomatically and economically. I think one of the reasons for that outcome was China in 1989 was vastly more diplomatically isolated. It was vastly more economically impoverished. I think now China is on the order of 16% of the global economy. It is integral to global supply chains. It's just that China now, economically and technologically, it has far more ability to shrug off external criticism.
And in terms of internal criticism, well, these days, there isn't much.
There's resentment of the inequalities, but I think even the people who aren't doing as well recognize that they're doing multiples better than how their parents did. And so they're much more accepting of it.
That's Peter Lorenzen,
professor of economics at the University of San Francisco. In the U.S., there's, you know, significant parts of the population that they're earning as much now as they did 40 years ago. And, you know, that kind of stagnation when other people or the rest of the economy is growing is what's most infuriating. I don't think there's no significant part of the population that's in that kind of position in China. Everyone is much better off than they were 40 years ago, even if they see that some people are, you know, more equal than others or they're getting unfair benefits and things like that.
So overall, China's people are happy. And the Chinese government's job is to keep it that way. But in the U.S., the predominant sentiment is things are bad. And they've been that way for a while. And there's no sign they're getting better.
From the mid-1970s onwards, you begin to see, I think, a pretty striking disconnect between America's engagement abroad and the material dividends that accrue to the middle class. I think that many members of the American public are saying, you know, I was sold a false bill of goods. And I think that that disillusionment now, it's really not even a partisan issue anymore. I think that disillusionment spans the ideological spectrum. And so I think that you put together those data points, and it's not only that the American public is demanding a greater focus on domestic issues, hence the need for a foreign policy that serves the middle class.
While the U.S. is working on turning things around for its own middle class, Scott says that China can continue on its current path as long as things keep looking good. He referenced a study done by an old colleague that showed that middle-income societies with a high degree of inequality, like China, can remain stable only so long as the people at the bottom are happy.
I think I'll be better off 10 years from now than I am now. That's sort of what kept this cohesion in this really unequal society.
But this could shift if China does fall into the middle income trap that we were talking about earlier, if too many jobs move overseas without enough higher paying jobs to replace them. Scott thinks there are signs that's already happening.
When wages for the unskilled labor went up, as soon as that happened, globalization and automation kicked in, and now they're laying off all these workers from manufacturing and construction, and wages are starting to fall. And so if people see, I don't have a stable job, I'm going to have falling wages, I don't think my life is going to be very good 10 years from now. And now it's unequal. You could see social problems happening, right?
I do think a critical distinction is that the United States does have a storied tradition of introspection, drawing on activist pressure from within and also criticism from without. I do think that it has a record of reckoning with socioeconomic challenges, not reckoning fully or sometimes even in a satisfactory manner, but reckoning nonetheless and acknowledging mistakes and trying to make amends.
The Supreme Court rules in 1954 that pupils cannot be segregated by law on the basis of race. A significant milestone in the history of a country proud of its heritage as a melting pot.
I don't get the sense that there is that type of introspection, at least publicly, that is occurring in China. And it was quite striking, you know, if you looked at those talks between high-ranking U.S. officials and their Chinese counterparts in Anchorage, and we see this type of narrative playing out again and again. So on the U.S. side, there was criticism of China, but there was also an acknowledgement of America's socioeconomic challenges.
A confident country is able to look hard at its own shortcomings and constantly seek to improve. And that is the secret sauce of America.
Peter does see at least one instance where China is showing a willingness to adjust to the will of the middle class.
Something China's middle class has become aware of is the growth in air pollution, because that's really something that they see every day in the major cities. And they look at their children coughing and they, you know, say, why is his asthma not getting better? That's my only child. The answer is because he's got to go outside. So that's been a huge wake-up call, I think, for the regime to say, okay, it's very pressing. That middle-class constituency is now concerned about it.
That's interesting. So we do see the regime then adapting these policies to then the pressure of this middle class that's grown, and so they've gained more influence?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's something that's often, you know, confusing when you're thinking about what's the difference between democracy and autocracy. You know, democracy, we get to elect the people, and if you get the voters upset, then you'll have a problem. They look at the Soviet Union, or they look at the Arab Spring, and they say, you know, you can't have everyone upset at you, right? You need to have some people on your side, and it can't just be like, you know, a 1% of the population that either has guns or money. It's got to be a little bit broader than that, or ultimately you might get booted unexpectedly. And so that urban middle class is really important to keep on the party's side.
Basically, China's middle class is thriving, but that doesn't mean it can coast, especially when it comes to addressing its massive income inequality and urban-rural divide. You've mentioned that China will have to deal with some of its inequalities, especially in its lower income, in order to continue to, is it fair to say, in order to continue to keep its economy chugging along?
I think what they need to do is overhaul health, education, early childhood development, yeah, and do a huge adult job retraining program. And I'm talking about huge. Mm-hmm. I mean, massive resources invested into that, which means raising unemployment insurance and paying people to get retrained. And that's not in their mentality. But with the economy that's growing slower, you have fiscal revenue problems. So you got to stop building the high-speed rails. I want China to go to Mars. I love Mars exploration. Go 20 years from now, right? Today, invest in your own population. Then they'll thrive. And 20 years from now, they can go to Venus, right?
Yeah.
And
that advice sounds remarkably similar to the U.S. advice.
I'm not an expert, but I would I'd vote for the person who'd say that.
Yeah. It bears mentioning that a thriving China is also good for the U.S. For one, if they get swept up into widespread unrest or turmoil, that could disrupt the many parts of our economy that are intertwined with theirs. For example, our tech companies need their researchers and scientists. And a lot of U.S. firms are invested in China. If those investments go south, we'll lose the capital that flows back into the States. Meanwhile, the U.S. middle class is stagnant, disillusioned, and fed up. The Biden administration's best bet at de-escalating some of the intense anger that's been directed at our institutions is to try to inspire some hope, to signal to the middle class that things are going to get better, perhaps even signal overtly by putting middle class in the name of one of its flagship policy strategies. Plus, getting our own house in order will score some points for us in the narrative battle with China over who's the greatest power. Unless, what if we change that narrative too?
I know it has become this shop-worn cliche talking point to say that, well, you know, the United States and China, they need to find a way of getting on because of these shared interests. I mean, sometimes when you bring up the inevitability and the necessity, the ongoing necessity of collaboration on these challenges, people will say you're being Pollyannish or you're being naive, but I don't think that the banality of the observation diminishes its enduring truth. And I cannot envision a scenario in which either Washington or Beijing can assure its own vital national interest if it either is unable or unwilling to sustain a baseline of cooperation with the other. So I think that the mandate for the United States is not how to achieve a decisive victory, but rather how to maintain a tenable cohabitation.
The world has a way of changing. And we change too.
Things That Go Boom is produced by Inkstick Media and distributed by PRX. This episode was produced by Emily Vaughn and me, and it was edited by Ruth Morris, Katie Toth, and Layla Ujaili. Darian Shulman writes the music for our show, and Robin Wise takes each episode over the finish line. A big thanks this episode to Ali Wine for all of his help pulling this episode together. And thanks to Michael Drummond for the heads up about the John Cena apology. As always, we want to thank the foundations that make our work possible, the Carnegie Corporation of New York and Plowshares Fund, as well as Inkstick supporters, including the Coulomb Foundation, Craig Newmark Foundation, Prospect Hill Foundation, and the Jubitz Family Foundation. And of course, always, 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 thank you to all of you for supporting our show. Don't forget, if you like the show, to leave us a review. You'd be surprised what a difference those things make. And, of course, you can come and visit us anytime on social at Inkstick Media. We'll see you right back here in 2 weeks.
Economists have discovered Babynomics. Yes, it's like, oh, what happens from 0 to 3 is important for both individual lifelong welfare as well as economic development. And yeah, so
I have a couple of little, I have 1 0 to 3 and I have a 0 in my belly right now, actually. So,
well, yeah, then you should read our stuff, you know.
I know. I gotta see what my babies need to do to support the economy. It's perfect.
From PRX.